Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 70 of the Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson. We got a good one for you this time. It's John Marsalis. John has been on the podcast before, almost exactly 2 years ago. You know him if you're a movie person as an accompanist for silent films. He's a terrific musician, and I always enjoy listening to him play for silent films, which I did just a couple of nights ago at the Academy when they played Lilac Time, which is a film I'd never seen, and it was a treat to be able to see it in 35. And with John playing the accompaniment. John is also a scientist. He develops drugs for infectious diseases, and so he's going around changing the world for the better every day. That makes him an incredibly interesting personality. So this is a very long episode, and I will make this short, and I will make it short on the other end as well. So enjoy John Marsalis. Last night we saw Lilac Time with your beautiful accompaniment, so let's talk about that. It occurs to me that there's an interesting dual way you approach playing for films, and one is the Cinecon way, which is pure improvisation, and then this was a set score. So give me a little bit of background on how you came to do this. I have no idea when you even wrote this score.
A lot of times when I play at a festival, I'm playing for very rare films, sometimes justifiably rare. There's a reason no one's seen them. But very rare things that we simply haven't seen. And you go in and just have to play it completely cold. And I mean, the extent of research I will often do on these is I'll read the one paragraph summary, if there is one, like the AFI book. And, basic Western, boy meets girl, boy gets girl, type approach. And, well, that's all I need to know. Or, oh, this is a society melodrama. And that's the extent of what I know. And I'm surprised as much as the audience when things happen. And that's fine. And after a while, you get good at doing that.
Do you get Western themes in your pocket that you can kind of go to? Or
I like to, as the lights are dimming, I like to think, what am I going to start with? And I have to know how to start. But then once it gets going, you kind of just find your way. So, I mean, that's fine, and I don't mind doing that. If I have the time, I prefer to actually put something together. So the Lilac Time, that's a film I've played, a number of times over the years. And I played it not terribly long ago, probably a couple years ago at Niles. We ran it. And so what I did last night is, I have this very high-end digital keyboard. It's a Kurzweil PC2X for the techies who care. That's got about 512 instruments in it. They licensed the Boston Symphony. So, when you set it to clarinet and you play a middle C, what you're playing is essentially an MP3 of the first clarinetist of the Boston Symphony playing a middle C. And, that's a slight oversimplification, but then they expand it out on the keys. So what I have done quite a bit of now, I've been doing this for over a decade, I think I got that keyboard in 2002, is I will fully orchestrate a film. And I'll go through, and the music I have an idea of what I'm going to play, certainly, in a film like Lilac Time, which has, it has World War I themes, it has, of course, Janine, I Dream of Lilac Time, very famous piece of music, a very popular tune. And so I worked that in as well. And so I will go through and I will orchestrate. Oh, this is a battle scene. I'm going to do horns. A lot of, you heard last night.
Sure.
Full brass for that. There's a very haunting scene where Colleen Moore wanders into the now deserted town just before it's bombed. And I actually have about eight different choirs on the keyboard. So I did that with choir. And it began with just vocals and then began to bring brass in. So I like doing that. I like orchestrating. And some of the sad scenes I would put and the way the keyboard's designed, I guess people don't care about the technical, but I can put the drums on the bottom six keys and fill out an orchestra in the middle. On the very top, I can put a cello. And I can set whatever octaves those are in. And so you heard some of there's a couple very sad scenes where, right where I came in, we'll talk about the Vitaphone score in a minute, where I came in, one of the flyers has just died. And so I actually come in with cello on the top and, a very soft, kind of sad piece of music, cello. So that's what I'll do. I'll go through, and if you saw on the music stand, I had two pages of notes. What those were largely were orchestration notes, and I can set up Oh, I mean, I'll typically, I think for that film, I started at 135 and ended at about 175. So I probably had about 40 orchestral setups. And I set it up more or less in chronological order. I begin the film at, you know, a number, and then I, you know, and I move on through. Sometimes I'll go back and forth if I'm alternating between, for example, a chase sequence and a romantic sequence. I'll have two, and I'll just toggle back and forth, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until I move on out of that. So that's how I laid it out. And I have, you know, two pages of notes. The music, I have very few notes, on the music. That is still mostly in my head. Now, what I did do, I mean, to me, the beginning is important because that's the first impression, and the end is important because that's the last impression. Yeah. So when I work on timing, I tend to focus mostly on the first and last 2 minutes of the film. Because quite honestly, you've probably forgotten a lot of what was in the middle, but you remember the end. So actually, for Lilac Time, I mean, I know the film very well, and I hope this isn't a spoiler alert for people who haven't seen the film, but, you know, Colleen Moore believes Gary Cooper's dead. She wanders off very sad, and then she looks up and sees him in this hospital window. And in scenes, and I love Lilac Time, it's a great film, but most of the elements in it are copied from either Big Parade or The Wings.
Sure.
Or Wings, you know, and they, Big Parade has that, you know, magnificent scene where Renee Adderay is hanging on the trucks as they're going on. So they say, well, let's have her hang on just like that on the ambulance that's taking him away. And then, of course, the dogfight sequences are very much part of Wings. So it's a derivative movie, but it's a very entertaining, lovable derivative movie.
Yeah. And she's so adorable overtakes anything else.
She's never looked better.
Yeah.
She's just completely adorable in that. So the final scene, she looks up in the window, she sees him, she runs, she has fight her way through the guards of the hospital, runs up a spiral staircase, can't find his room, runs into the room, they hug, they kiss, the end. So I actually just, I had put this score together a couple years ago when I played it at Niles. And I would just, quite honestly, and again from a technology standpoint, I have all the setups saved on a computer, and I just go to my keyboard and I just upload the Lilac Time, and then I'm all ready to go. And that's the advantage of. So when they asked me to do this a few weeks ago, I said, well, yeah, this won't take a lot of prep because I've already got it orchestrated. And so I do go through it again, and I kind of, I actually ran this with the film because I knew there was going to be an important audience of people like you, Frank.
Well,
so I wanted to make sure I had the timing right. And then I went through, and of the 40 or so setups, I probably re-tinkered about 10 of them. I said, well, I don't like the way this sounds. Let's change this. I was using harp. I don't like harp. Let's use guitar. It sounds better.
It's a very convincing guitar sound you get on that
thing. It's a very convincing guitar sound. I mean, a number of the sounds are, it's astonishing how good the technology is. And people will come up and say, oh, it's a synthesizer. You know, Leonard Maltin came up afterwards and he said, oh, I've never heard you play on a synthesizer. Well, it's not a synthesizer. A synthesizer is something it uses oscillators to emulate a sound, but it's not a real sound. Synthesizer is what Rick Wakeman played in. Yes,
sure.
That's a synthesizer. You know, Mini Moog is a synthesizer. You know, this is a digital keyboard. Some people would call it a sampling keyboard. We've digitally captured real sounds of instruments. And so if you instrument it right and you get the actions right and the attacks and the decays and that, which, you know, nowadays with technology, I mean, heck, we can make dinosaurs appear on the screen. You swear they're real. Of course we can do the same with sound.
Yeah.
So I went through, but earlier this week, I mean, I ran the end. I put on 16mm print, and I ran the end, probably 7-8 times to get, not getting it quite right. Oh, she's on the stairs too soon. Oh, I'm running out of music, or I've got too much music. So I actually did practice the end, spent about an hour just running the ending. So I put a little more effort into it. So then when I came in, so then we can talk about last night. What was different about last night is that, and this project began when Ben Burt, and I've known Ben for a number of years, we've done some projects together, and Ben approached me several months ago and says, well, we're doing this aviation series, we're interested in running Lilac Time, what do you know about Prince? And I said, well, you know, there are 16s around, and, you know, UA released, this is one of only two films they released in a really very good quality 8mm print years ago. I said, I have no idea what survives in 35. So I gave them some hints, and they went off, and he did all the legwork, and they found this one 35mm print at Warner Brothers. Not unrestored print. I believe it's from the British release, where they retitled her Genie. The print needed a little work. It was a good quality print, but it definitely could use a restoration. Sure. We need to redo the titles. The main title cards are very dirty and could be cleaned up.
And you know they had beautiful art cards for that, for the original release too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so anyway, so they, but that's what they had. So then he had approached me and he said, would you be interested in playing this? So then I'd never played at the Academy, and you know, it's a bit of a slog for me to drive the 5.5 hours down, but I said, well, this would be fun. So I came down for it and set up. But then while we were in planning in the late stages, he said, you know, we found the first Vitaphone disc. And it was apparently in quite bad shape. And, you know, Ben, being the sound effect whiz that he is, yeah, he did his best to clean it up. And so we had about 8 minutes of the original, from the starting with the opening credits. And that was manually synced last night, and they did an extremely good job.
They sure did.
So he had sent that to me, and I said, well, so we're going to transition. I want to get it as smooth as possible. And it transitions at a scene where the first flyer has died and is being carried off, and it goes to a very quiet scene, and the music kind of fades out. And I don't know if they intentionally broke the disc, you know, made the disc, the break occur there, because it is a kind of a quiet transition period. You wouldn't want it to transition over in the middle of a dogfight, for
sure,
example. And so I matched the key. So Ben sent it to me, and I said, okay, this is ending at, you know, this note, and I what we did, and we'd rehearsed this in the afternoon, is there was the theater manager sitting at the soundboard, and they did a fade out of the Vitaphone and a fade in of me on a couple of notes. A couple people afterwards said, you know, it took me a minute to realize when you had transitioned, other than the,
yep,
you know, the very noisy disc, and you heard it at the end, it got very bad.
Sure.
There were skips and huge amount of disc noise. And only because the disc noise ended, you know, we transitioned in, and then I played the rest of the picture. So that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question of how we did it. I've done similar things. I've done something in reverse. I have a nice 16mm print of Submarine, the Frank Capra. And for that, the last two reels, the sound exists, and the rest is lost. So we did that at Syracuse some years ago, and I played the entire film, and I'd worked with the projectionist, and we queued it up to where I faded out, and they faded in for the big exciting climax, faded in the original score. And it's fun to do things like that. I mean, it's fun to play the whole film.
Sure.
But it's entertaining for the audience to get that transition of what it's like from live into recording or vice versa.
Now, was there ever a time on this Lilac Time score that you wrote it out as a score? Or did you just make notes for yourself to remember what
you
were going to do?
Well, with one exception, I've only once actually prepared what I would call a score, and that was quite recently. I sight read so badly, and even read my own notes and music so badly. I've never been one to play off of sheet music. The exception to that is recently. I did pretty much about 85% of the Hugo Riesenfeld score for Sunrise. And we did it, the 85th anniversary of when Sunrise won the most artistic achievement Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
We were one day off. It was on a Friday, and the day after we did Sunrise. And I said, well, I've always wanted to do this and try doing the Riesenfeld score. Because, I mean, I grew up with it.
Sure.
And I liked that, but at the same time, you know, people want to hear it live. And most theaters ran Sunrise with music because, you know, in 27, there just weren't many theaters wired for sound. And so on that, I pulled it together. Now, there, to my knowledge, and I asked around and did some research, there is no Riesenfeld score. You know, you don't get a 3-inch stack of music that says Sunrise, Hugo Riesenfeld. It's a compiled score, and there's Chopin in there.
Yeah.
There's Gounod, lots of things. And but there's original music. So on that, I actually went through and first where it was, you know, Chopin and Gounod and others. You know, I just found the sheet music, and I worked it in. And again, it wasn't exactly the original music; it was a variation. But for much of it, I had to sit there very slowly, stopping over and over the disc and listening, you know, and writing down the basic melodies. A significant proportion of it, I would say about 60% of the score I did was the Riesenfeld score. About 20% was pretty close to the Riesenfeld score. I mean, it was certainly in the spirit of the Riesenfeld score. And then about 20%, I said, well, this just doesn't work. Because a lot of the film, too, if you've seen it, was reissued with what I would call excessive sound effects. You know, it was like in the, I introduced the film, and I said, it's like in the early days of 3D, they didn't know what to do with it. So what you do with 3D is you throw everything at the audience.
Sure.
And that gets tiresome. And in the early days of sound, well, you know, we want to have a loud cowbell here in the cow scene. We want to have all these random sounds. I mean, it's fascinating to listen to, but for a live performance, that would be a bit much. So in some of those places, which I would describe as orchestrated noise, I mean, I just changed it. It's my prerogative as the person performing. So that is, though, the only time really where I would say I have assembled something resembling a score. And I mean, I had a book and I was turning the pages and going through. I've done other things where there's a popular theme, you know, Laugh Clown Laugh, Charmaine from What Price Glory, Diane from Seventh Heaven, you know, Angela Mio from Street Angel. I mean, those are films that had, you know, a popular theme, and I would learn the theme and I would work it in and out of the film, but I'm still largely improvised. You know, if you want somebody to come in and pull out an original score, you know, get Frederick Hodges or someone like that to do it. You know, they're terrific at that.
Sure.
That's just not my thing. So,
well, the reason I ask about the Lilac Time score is that it seemed to me extremely precise in many instances that you really nailed the scoring very specifically to what was happening. And so I knew that was at least pre-planned, that because even if you were improvising, even if you kind of had an idea that, oh, I need to play taps at this moment, I don't think you'd nail it quite on the head like you did.
Well,
so
the tap sequence is one. That's a very powerful scene in the movie.
Yeah.
And again, for listeners, that's a scene where it's early in the film. In fact, it was right after the Vitaphone score ran out, and it was 30 seconds in. And again, remember, I always say, you know, you want to start strong, so I made sure I had that. And the scene where they're pouring the glasses, and then they get to the empty glass of the flyer, and they end up toasting the flyer, and then take his glass, and they shatter it, and then put it up on the shelf with all the other broken glasses that you see all the flyers that have died. So that was one where, I mean, I said to myself when I did a dry run, you know, a few days ago, I said, you know, the second she begins pouring, you know, I'm going to do taps.
Yeah.
So I had that, and I'd rehearsed it once, and I said, oh, the timing is perfect. This hits perfectly. And so that was one I did. And there are a couple other scenes like that where, you know, again, I know what I'm going to play, and I'm just watching. Okay, scene is starting now. Let's start the cello. In fact, you can see I've gotten, as many of us have, you know, on you see a lot of silent films, you get good at reading lips. And so the scene where Colleen Moore believes Gary Cooper has died, and you can see she read lips. She says, he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the scene, you know, and I was watching for that. As soon as she says, he's dead, and you say, oh, my gosh, it's just realization. That's where I begin this very sad cello music.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's I'm giving away secrets here. It sounds like this is brilliantly orchestrated and hours put in. I'm just, people ask me, I said, how do you know what to play? And I say, you know, have you ever watched a tennis match? They go, well, yeah. I said, that ball is coming at you at 60 miles an hour. How the heck do they know where to put the racket?
Sure.
Well, they just do. It's called practice.
Practice.
You learn to watch what's coming. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I talked about this last podcast I did a couple years ago, so I won't, you know, revisit it. But, you know, sometimes you get thrown, but most of the time, especially certainly if you know a film, you should not get thrown. The other scene where the guy comes in, the flyers just died, and he puts on this real bouncy music, and the other guy starts screaming at him, take it off. And, you know, again, that's the, I'm watching, and the second he puts that needle down, I go into this very jazzy saxophone,
sure,
you know, based thing for a few seconds until they scream, and then he takes it off, and then the second he takes it off, I stop. So again, that didn't take a lot of rehearsal. It's just, it takes paying attention to what's on the screen.
How many years have you been going to CineCon?
So I've been going to CineCon since 1974. It is 40 years. So we're coming up on CineCon 50. It's a big event in a few weeks, from when we're recording this. I've only missed four in 40 years. Two when I was I was in graduate school and didn't have the money. I think those were both in L.A. One because I was deathly ill with a kidney stone, and one that I didn't go out of protest. And we'll come and talk about that when we get to talk about CineCon history.
When did you start playing accompaniment there?
First time I performed was 77. So in those early few years, I was in graduate school, but I got my doctorate in 79, and starting around 79 on, I became very heavily involved. From 81 to 91, I would say I was probably one of the one or two most key people in the organization. And the reason I say that is two of those 10 years, I was the president. One year, I hosted the CineCon in San Francisco, along with Rob McKay's help. And I was a newsletter editor in there. And I was also involved during the transition period of when we went from what I would call a film collector's convention to an archive/studio-based convention, and the permanent transition to Hollywood and the transition to when we became a nonprofit corporation. So I was heavily involved during that sort of 10-year transition period. I've remained involved, but, I mean, the guys in Hollywood and L.A. area do a great job. They don't need me. But I continue to provide suggestions of films. They're always coming to me asking for archival things. I've, of course, been playing and accompanying for many, many years. But in terms of the planning and organization, since I was president, actually, I think 91 to 92. Or 90 to 91, sorry. And after that time, I haven't had too much involvement other than as sort of the wise old fool is sometimes called for advice.
But you've played virtually every year since then.
I've played, yeah. I said, except for the four that I've missed, I've played every year from 77 on.
Now, I don't have any idea why you would be in protest. There's a part of CineCon history that I don't know, I guess.
Well, let's back up a little and talk. Because there's two interrelated topics that are important to understanding about CineCon. One is kind of the history of film collecting itself and how that led to the formation of the group that did, which was originally the Society for Cinephiles, that created the CineCon and why they did it. So, film collecting, collecting goes, everybody collects. I have a son who collects bottle caps. And, we all collect something, whether it be baseball cards or Famous Monsters magazines or coins or stamps or busts of Mozart. I mean, it's just, there's some evolutionary thing. It's the same gene that makes squirrels collect acorns for the winter. there's something we all want to collect in on something. And so part of film collecting is that. There's people, they just want to have it. There was a collector I won't name, but we always joked that, he didn't actually care about watching the films. He wanted it on the shelf. Yeah. And we always joked that we were going to take some film, we were going to take the first 2 minutes of the film and splice it onto some junk and see if he ever noticed, because he would always watch the first 1 or 2 minutes and say, oh, this is a nice print, and then he'd put it on the shelf and never watch it. So there's some of that. But a lot of what drove film collecting is that people wanted to be able to see films when they wanted. And you've talked about this with many of your guests in the past, and so this is old territory we're treading, but and it's a little bit of a, I hiked through the 10 miles of the snow to go to school when I was young story. But nowadays, if you want to see a movie, unless something incredibly rare, you just see it. You stream it, you Amazon it, you Netflix it, you if it's an older movie, you go to Turner and they press you a custom DVD. I mean, there's Turner Classic Movies. I mean, it's not very hard. I mean, obviously there's rare archival material that is still difficult, and the kinds of things we run at CineCon now. It's not very difficult. But I like to tell the story. In 1977, five of us drove from Raleigh, North Carolina to Minneapolis, 26 hours each way, to see incredibly rare films. The Three Ages with Buster Keaton, Girl Shy and The Sailor Made Man with Harold Lloyd, Tell It to the Marines with Lon Chaney, And Scarface.
Wow.
The Paul Muni. Unspeakably rare films. Yeah. Every one of those now readily available on DVD.
You can at our fingertips.
Stream all of them or YouTube them or something. And we were willing to commit to see those films. They were so rare. They were so impossible to see. And it was so exciting to see them. And so, you know, film collecting began as people that they wanted to see these films. And I know you've said this in the past, that people have, you know, once something appeared in the theater, you just didn't see it again. And then when television came along, you could wait for it to run. I still have vivid memories of when I was 4 years old. King Kong came on TV for the first time in television syndication. It was 1957. It had never been on television. Television was still a new medium. My dad was a huge King Kong fan. He tells a story. He says, "Yeah, I was 15 years old, and I can still take you down to the Lowe's State Theater and show you where my thumbprints are embedded in the armrest from when Kong first appeared on the screen." So this was this exciting thing. They let me. It was on the 11:30 movie, and I was 4 years old. They let me go to bed early, and then they woke me up at 11:25, and we watched King Kong in this little probably 17-inch black and white set down in our basement, and you know, changed my life. That's what got me interested in movies and in particular in horror films. But that's what you had to go through to see King Kong.
Sure.
And then I love King Kong, still my favorite sound film. You couldn't see it in Cleveland for many years because there was an odd broadcasting rule that they wouldn't sell a package to two networks in a competing market. And so Youngstown, Ohio, had the CNC TV package with King Kong, but our antenna wasn't good enough to pick up Youngstown, but it was close enough that the Cleveland stations couldn't run it. So I did tell this story in the last podcast, but it'll be the only one I'll repeat because it's worth it for context. So I always, when King Kong was playing somewhere, I always, you know, went to see it. And I'd see it on college campuses and things when I was at Kent State. And so my mom said, it was 1974, it was the summer before my senior year in college, my mom said, "Hey, a local public library, South Euclid Public Library, is running King Kong for free." I said, "Oh, I'll go over and see." And I went over, and it was a free summer movie program hosted by the Big Business Tent of Sons of the Desert in Cleveland. And I went over, and they were running King Kong, and it was a 16-millimeter Duke print, like most things we'd seen at the time. And I just said to one of the guys, I said, "Where did you get this print? I mean, did you go to a rental library?" And I was surprised they weren't charging admission. He said, "Oh, no, the print belongs to him." And he pointed to Rick Green, who now lives here in the L.A. area. He was 15 years old. And I said, "That kid owns a print of King Kong." I thought, well, if he owns a print of King Kong, I can own King Kong. And that began me down this addictive path of film collecting. And that was the summer that they said, there's this film festival called CineCon in New Haven, Connecticut. And some of us would like to go, and they knew I had access to my parents' car and could drive them. So a group of us drove to CineCon, and I confess now, I should say, we stole our badges. It was $5. We were poor students. We stole badges so that we could sneak in, and we slept five in a hotel room, so each night there would be two in one bed, two in another bed, and one on the floor. We took turns on the floor, and that's what you had to do to, no money. We're all poor students. And so that was my introduction to CineCon. But getting back to film collecting's been going on since, way back. In the 1920s and 30s, a number of studios released films in 16mm through either the Kodoscope or the Show at Home libraries, for example. There were other independent, Hollywood Film Exchange did it. And these were intended largely for educational market. It wasn't so much for, collectors are going to buy these. It was, schools and churches and the military, want to have 16mm films. This is when nitrate was in use in studios. They called it, they said, we need something that isn't flammable if we're going to schools and churches. So Kodak came up with what they called safety film, which was at the time originally a diacetate base, then later it went to a triacetate. The diacetate gives off this very interesting smell that those of us who collect know, and you open a can and you go, "Ah, I love that diacetate smell." Later we went to triacetate, which breaks down to gets vinegar syndrome, which is probably less stable than nitrate, as it turns out. But they began producing these films, and the way they produced them is they would go to the camera negative and strike these, and they were often printed on tinted stock. Some people think, these Kodoscopes, they hand tinted them. Well, no, Kodak actually made, you could buy. In fact, up until as recently as maybe 20 years ago, you could still buy from Kodak Kodak 16mm pre-tinted stock, and they actually put the color right in the base, so the color never fades. And you could buy, you know, blues and ambers and reds. And many of the Kodascopes were just printed on amber, and we all call it now, you know, beautiful amber original.
Sure.
But some of the more impressive ones, they would, you know, from Conductor 1492 is a good example. Big Fire Scene, they printed on red stock. And Night Scenes, they would print on blue stock. And so so they released these very beautiful quality prints. Now, sometimes they were cut. The Kodascopes, Warner Brothers and Paramount released the Kodascopes. And they would cut all of those to 5 or 6 reels. And so if it was an 8-reel picture, what many films only exist today in those Kodascope prints. And they would cut it. And so it's a slight cut down, but they were professionally edited. I mean, they would give it to somebody at Paramount, and they'd say, you know, cut us a 6-reel. They would strike a 35mm negative off the camera negative and then print the Kodascopes directly from, in many cases. They apparently never made 16mm inner negatives, and certainly no inner negatives have ever been discovered. Most of the Kodascope material is all at George Eastman House now. And of course, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Sure. Back is there. And they would print these, you know, gorgeous prints. So people began collecting these because collectors, they would be sold through camera stores, for example. And, you know, in the 1950s, as television was coming in, you know, you could still go, even into the 60s, you could go to camera stores. And people would say, well, yeah, I got some of those old films in the back. And so some of the legendary collectors, you know, people like David Shepard, who's been on the show, Gordon Burkow, you know, of course, Bill Everson, David Bradley, people like that, you know, they would make the rounds in, you know, the 1940s, 1950s, and they would buy up these prints. And they're very prized today by collectors. But what then began to happen is in the 1950s and 60s, people started striking 8mm prints. And there's 8mm prints back as we've certainly found them as far back as the 1920s. In fact, for many years, Romola, the Henry King picture mm-hmm. with Lillian Gish, Ronald Coleman, William Powell, Dorothy Gish, that survived as an 8mm amber original print. And that was in the Hampton collection. And then I know a collector who eventually purchased that from Lawrence Austin, who got the Hampton collection. But 8mm collecting became popular. It was 8mm was a common home movie format. People shot home movies in 8. It was very inexpensive, and so some enterprising distributors began to make 8mm films. And you know, you've had David Shepard on the show. He's talked about Black Hawk, which started as a railroad, a railroad pick and movie company, and then expanded into other things. Bob Lee in New Jersey ran Essex Film Club, and he formed Griggs Movie Drome. Thunderbird films, so all these films they began putting out initially 8mm and then began 16mm. And the way Cinecon got started is there was a furniture salesman named Samuel K. Rubin, and Sam lived in Indiana, Pennsylvania, and he, you know, a lot of the guys who started this, you know, they were in their 50s at the time, and they remembered seeing silent films as boys. And they were, you know, and so they remembered, oh, The Thief of Baghdad and The General, and it made such an impression. It's, gosh, I wish I could see that film again. And at that time, I mean, we didn't even have Paul Killian putting out films on television yet. And they said, how can I see these films? And so they learned that there were copies around, and they could get 8mm prints struck. And so Sam started a little publication called the 8mm Film Collector. And the early issues, I mean, literally, it's not much more than what I described as mimeographed. I mean, it's the very simple, crude issues. And he found collectors, and word spread. He advertised it in things like American Cinematographer, which was around at the time, and other photographic magazines. And he began to get a following. And eventually, 16mm collectors said, hey, what about us? And so then I think for a while, a few issues, it was 8 and 16mm film collector. Then it became Classic Film Collector. It was Classic Film Collector for many years. And then eventually got sold to a conglomerate that published these things. It became Classic Images, and Sam moved to Iowa and actually was the editor for many years. So Sam, you know, was putting out, and the people began corresponding. It was back in the old days when the only way to correspond was with a typewriter and a postage stamp. And people said, you know, we ought to do a get-together. And so the fellow who actually I don't know, named Tom Sellers, Sellers, who was the one who really organized. It was Sam's idea, but Tom had put together this idea of let's get a group. And the first CineCon was in Indiana, Pennsylvania in 1965. And it really was a let's get a room at a hotel, we'll set up a couple of projectors and people will bring stuff and we'll project them. And, you know, there was a little planning that went into it of, well, oh, can you bring your print of Thief of Baghdad? Oh, can you bring your print of, you know, this or that? And it was very much a middle-aged white men kind of thing. And, you know, very unorchestrated, and people would you know, bring films and screen them. And that's how it was for the first few years, which is why they were in, you know, big megapolises like, you know, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Baraboo, Wisconsin. Because there would be someone there to agree to be the host. And guys say, well, I'll host it. And to be a host at the time, all you really had to do was get a hotel to agree to give you a room and say, well, we got some people coming in. They'd usually give you a free room. And that was it. And so that was the early days of CineCon. And again, when I was not attendee, I didn't go till CineCon 10. Well, then there were people, you know, who were very immersed in it, and, you know, just, you know, with a passionate love for old films, as many of us have. And they said, well, you know, I know some stars. You know, I'm friends with Blanche Sweet. Can I bring her along? You know, well, yeah. You know, and at the time, you know, again, the 1960s, I mean, they're in their 70s.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, they're very spry. Some of us aren't too far away from hitting our 70s ourselves. And they're thrilled that someone remembered them. And so you began bringing stars. Well, then it started to escalate. Well, gee, if we have stars, you know, we kind of just can't have them sitting around. You know, we ought to do an event. So then they started doing what they called the awards banquet. And the hotels were always happy to cater these because it's more money. And they would give out awards. One of the early awards that they gave was the Sissy Rubin Award. Sam Rubin had a wife that passed away from cancer. In fact, Sam kind of sadly has lost a couple wives to cancer. And in fact, kind of a dark joke was, you know, if you're a woman, don't marry Sam, because, you know, he did have, you know, a few with very dear, sweet women who, you know, had developed terminal cancer and died. And it was very hard on Sam and hard on many of us who, you know, had befriended Sam and knew his family. And, so we had the Sissy Rubin Award for a number of years. It was always an achievement award. We would typically bring people in and give them something. We still do that today. And so it grew, and it got to be a bigger deal. Well, then people said, well, you know, there's not a lot of silent material out there, but, you know, we're really interested in early sound. So it started to grow into an early sound. And then pretty soon the 8mm went away, and at the conventions, it, you know, because that doesn't project really well in any kind of large venue. And for many years, it was a 16mm venue. Well, then as you begin to get into the 70s, and when I started getting involved, they said, well, you know, gee, we've got, you know, this, you know, a theater or archive or museum. You know, it was in Hollywood. Oh, we've got UCLA and the Academy, and, you know, we can get a 35mm. And so you began talking to the archives. There were some collectors that had 35, but, you know, you talk to Library of Congress or UCLA and say, you know, hey, can we get a print of, you know, such and such film. And this is back at a time when UCLA said, oh, yeah, we can run the nitrate of follow through. And so it began to get 35mm screenings. Well, that increased complexity because now you have to bus people to theaters. So it started to, you know, it went from what was really an amateur convention of, hey, let's get together and watch films like you do in someone's basement. It started to grow, and by the 70s, it was getting into a production. It was getting to be a big deal. You know, they call 35mm the spoiler. As you start watching 35, you know, I mean, 16 does look great in our basements, and, you know, we all have lots of 16. Yeah. But you know, after you've seen a, you know, 35, you know, Technicolor nitrate print, you go, wow, I don't really want to go back to that. So there was more and more of a push to go into 35. And so it started to become a tradition that, you know, you had to have 35 screenings. So, as I said, I started attending in 74. I missed 75 because that's what literally was the week that I started graduate school. And it was in Hollywood and I couldn't go. And then 76 was New York City. And I had a girlfriend at the time who's from New York City. And so she used as an excuse. We, you know, took the weekend, drove up. She visited her family. And then I went to the CineCon. And, you know, and then I can probably name them all. I mean, from that point on, 74 was New Haven, 75 was Hollywood, 76 was New York, 77 was Minneapolis. And that was that wonderful one I told you about. And you know, it wouldn't necessarily be stars. We had, I vividly remember that. It was one of my all-time favorite Cinecons, besides these rare films like The Three Ages and Scarface that we ran. We had, we brought in guests, you know, Lee Garms, cinematographer. Oh. And, you know, and that was one reason we ran Scarface, because he was a cinematographer on that. And, you know, wonderful guy, told amazing stories. And we'd get him for the whole weekend. You know, you'd be sitting and talking to him throughout the weekend. Ken Murray, who's famous for doing home movies. Arthur Kleiner, kind of a legendary silent movie pianist, and they brought in Queen Kelly, which is another very rare film at the time, which is now on DVD, but, you know, an unspeakably rare film. He played... I believe it was the original score for Queen Kelly. And so, you know, these great events. 78 was Syracuse. Phil Serling did it, and it was actually, to digress slightly, a couple years later, he said, you know, that was so much fun, I'd like to start doing this regularly. So in 81, he began doing the Syracuse Cinefest, and I was the only accompanist at Syracuse for about the first 7 or 8 years, and it started very small. I think the first one was, you know, 100 people or so, and that has grown into, still today, you know, a very large major event in Syracuse. And so 78. Then 79 was New York City. That was the one, I won't name his name because he's still alive, but there was an accompanist who showed up, and Ed Hulse did the convention, and forgot to put our names in the program. And I'm like, well, whatever. And the other accompanist came in, saw his name was in the program, was outraged, and stormed out. And so I was the only accompanist. Well, then Ed panicked. He got Don Sosin, who I love and adore, fabulous accompanist, one of my favorites. He came in and did a couple shows, but he had other commitments. And so that spelled me a little. But I played the whole weekend. And I'll come back later and tell you a group. One of my favorite CineCon stories about 79. But
I was there. That was my first one. Yeah.
But so 79 in New York, 80 Hollywood, which I missed. Again, I was in a transition year. I'd finished my PhD. I was doing a postdoc. But then from 81 on, I became quite involved. 81 was Kansas City. Doug Moore did it. Doug was an interesting guy. I really liked Doug. Doug was someone when I was young, he kind of took me under his wing, and he lived 4 hours from me when I was in graduate school, and every time I'd visit, he'd send me home with a trunkload of films to watch. And many of these early silents, I saw them for the first time because Doug didn't know me that well, said, here, borrow these 50 films. And he would send me home with a trunkload of film. And then I'd go back some months later and get more. But Doug could be an irritating guy, and he developed a reputation for being hard to deal with. A lot of collectors and archives didn't want to deal with him. Doug said, can you put the film program together? So I programmed, and actually I had help from David Pierce, who's, of course, went on to be director of the Film Archive at the British Film Institute, and I've known David since he was in 10th grade. David came, I digress to my David Pierce story, when I was playing at North Carolina State, I was there in graduate school, and I was on the film program, film committee, 2 weeks after I came to the school, and by the end of the first semester, I was running it. And so I did a big silent series the following fall. And I did Steamboat Bill Jr., and this young kid came up to me, this high school kid, and he said, you know, hi, Mr. Marsalis, can you tell me, did you get that film from Raymond Rohauer? And here's this little kid. I said, how on earth do you know who Raymond Rohauer is? Well, that's how I met David Pierce, who, even in 10th grade, was insanely knowledgeable, as he is today. So David helped me on 81, and then 82 was in Davenport, Iowa. Sam Rubin did it. Again, Sam, you know, was a great guy, knew a lot about organizing the town and could do the hotel. He needed help with the film program, so I helped do that. I wrote all the program notes. By that point, I had moved to San Francisco. I moved to San Francisco in 81. I'd met Rob McKay, who to this day is one of my best friends. And Rob and I started talking about doing it in San Francisco. So, but the way CineCon worked, though, is, you know, you'd have the CineCon in a city, and then you'd have a business meeting, usually on Sunday morning, and someone would get up to host. And someone would stand up and say, I'd like to offer, you know, Minneapolis next year. And some years you'd have 3-4 competing bids. And I know in 82, we had bids for Houston, Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles, I think. And we ended up picking Chicago. And some years or the word would get out. So I wanted to do a preemptive strike. So in 82, I said, by the way, next year we're going to be offering San Francisco for 84. That was the first time anyone gave 2 years notice. So in 83, I wasn't involved. I was actually president from 81 to 82. I got elected president. The president is largely a ceremonial position. The president only does two things. They kind of run the business meeting. They host the banquet. The president's traditionally the host of the banquet. And when there are issues that arise in society, and there weren't a lot of issues in the early days, we did get later when we began to incorporate, there's not much to do, but, you know, sometimes, you know, you'd get a situation where a labor union would give you a hard time because you're not using union production.
Sure.
You'd have to fire off a letter. And, you know, Howard Kolodny, who was a, you know, past president, long-time member, he was an attorney and our official legal counsel. Whenever we needed a legal letter, we'd get Howard to fire something off, and you know that would usually bring any unrest to a halt. In '83, actually, an interesting story. You know, Chicago is a very heavy union town, and two union goons, and that's the only way to describe them, great big burly guys, showed up and said, "We understand you're showing movies here and not using a union projectionist." And and Robert Miller was the host that year, and so they quickly called him, and he comes over, and he had anticipated this, and he was prepared. He said, "Oh, hi, I'm Professor Miller," and he is a professor. He teaches at a university, and they said, "Professor Miller." He said, "Well, yes, I'm at," and I don't remember if he's Northwestern or he teaches film history at one of the Chicago schools, and these two guys looked at each other. And he said, "Can I help you?" They said, "Well, we're from the union." He said, "Oh, you know that educational is exempt, don't you?" And they kind of looked at each other and said, "Oh," and they turned around and left. So occasionally the president will get involved in those kinds of things that come up. But the president doesn't do a lot, but has to help make sure things keep moving along.
Sure.
During the year. We have had years where someone, for example, the newsletter editor wouldn't get out a newsletter. And you had to quickly step in and find someone who would help do it. So I was president from 81 to 82, and then Chicago was 83. And then we did San Francisco. I hosted one CineCon with a huge amount of help from Rob McKay. I will never do it again. I have the utmost respect for these guys who do it year after year. It is a horrible, grueling, thankless job. And by the time we were getting to 84 is when we were in that transition period of it's no longer an amateur event. We had about 8 celebrities come in. And just getting them in and out, some were local, some were in Hollywood. You know, we called in a lot of chips and had a lot of our friends. You know, Esther Alston, Mary Bryan, Nell O'Day came, Bernice Clare, musical star from the early 30s, Warners, lived in Sausalito. We had animators. We had Retta Scott, who did the Sorcerer's Apprentice sequence in Fantasia. She was local, and so I called my animation friends. She was Bambi. Forget the animator's name, who did Sorcerer's Apprentice. They were both there, and we did a whole animation thing. But when you're running the CineCon, you have to deal with getting the films, getting the guests, and lining it up. Having 2 years to prepare is that's doable. Getting the hotel dealt with. You've got a dealer's room. You have a registration desk. You have to get projectionists. And then we did 2 35 millimeter events. We did a morning at the Castro Theater, and then we did a morning at Pacific Film Archive. And so you had to arrange buses for Pacific Film Archive. One of the buses got lost on the way to Berkeley. Came in late. So it's a horrible job, and my story that kind of sums up what CineCon was like, it was, at the time, now we start Thursday afternoon or evening, but you began showing films Friday morning, so you had all day Thursday to set up. So I was running around like a one-armed paper hanger on Thursday getting things in place, and the invariable problems, you know, a print didn't show, and, you know, you always have a couple backup prints. Although that convention, I have to say, that is the only CineCon we may have done it since, where every film that was announced was shown, and everything started within 5 minutes of on time.
Wow.
That is almost, I take great pride in that. But
that has never happened again. No.
But my story, I mean, I was horribly short-staffed. I mean, I just didn't have, you know, they have a huge crew here in Hollywood to do the CineCon now. I just didn't have enough people. I had only moved to the Bay Area in 81. I didn't know a lot of the collectors. We didn't have a large number of collectors. I was lucky that I had a large group working for me in my day job, and I offered a bunch of them the afternoon off if they would come up and work registration desks. And so a number of them came, and a lot of them just, they wanted to be nice to the boss, and so they came, and some volunteered on the weekend. Friend of mine at the time, even I taught her how to project, and she was pretty good, and she served as projectionist for a number of shows. But my great story about what the CineCon was like, I can sum it up with one anecdote. It was about Friday afternoon, and I was sitting at the registration desk, and I just started shaking. I just started getting, like I was given nerve gas or something. I just started tremoring, and apparently all the color drained out of my face. And one of my coworkers from work was sitting next to me. She said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I have no idea." And she looked at me. She said, "When was the last time you ate?" And I said, "What day is this?" She said, "It's Friday." And I thought for a minute. I said, "I had dinner on Wednesday."
Wow.
I had been so busy and so stressed, I had forgotten to eat. And I'd gone 48 hours, and I was hypoglycemic and probably about to go into a coma. So she said, "Don't move." And she raced over and got some food and fed me. And then I was okay. But it was a horrible experience doing it. So I mean I can look back now. There were some great moments, but it was very hard to do. So I said, "This is the last time I'm doing this." But then within a year I volunteered to do the newsletter. So I think I did the newsletter from 85 to 86 or thereabouts. So then we had gone through this period of someone would get up to host, and we had some great people. Ed Hulse did a couple in New York City. Marty Kearns did a couple in Hollywood. Ron Hall did two in Minneapolis. I did San Francisco. We had some great, great events. What started to happen by the mid-80s was two things. First, again, we were getting increasingly complex. More people were demanding 35 millimeter. More people wanted guests. And once you get out of the Hollywood, New York City area, it's harder to get guests. Doug Moore in Kansas City did it because his aunt is Pauline Moore, who's in Young Mr. Lincoln and films like that.
Sure.
And so he can call Aunt Polly, and yeah, she'll come out. But you quickly run out of opportunities to do things like that. And they were getting, the budgets were going up, and they were getting increasingly expensive to do. San Francisco actually lost $2,000 because we didn't make the room guarantee. A lot of people at the time, I remember the hotel was $75 a night, which in 1984 was pricey.
Yeah.
And a lot of people came in for it and stayed at other hotels because they didn't want... We did it at the Sheraton Palace, the hotel that Caruso slept in the night of the 1906 earthquake. It's a legendary hotel in San Francisco. We actually were going to do the Fairmont because, of course, that's where the Fatty Arbuckle debacle occurred. And it was interesting when we went in. We toured the Fairmont, and it didn't have the right room layout. It wasn't going to work for us. But I said, well, of course, we're interested because of, of the historic importance of this because of Fatty Arbuckle. And the manager immediately said, "Oh, that wasn't this hotel." I said, "Well, yes, it was." No. That you're confusing that with another hotel. I said, "No, believe me, I know my history. It is absolutely this hotel. It is this hotel at this site." I said, "Come on." No, you're confused. And so that was another reason we didn't go with the Fairmont. They were a little irritating. So it was getting increasingly difficult to do these. And the small number of people in the cities that could pull it off and the people with the wherewithal to do it, they were burning out. And so what happened is we went into what I call the dark years, and which is like 87, 88, 89. And what happened is, and this is important because it gets to why it's now in Hollywood all the time. These were conventions that very well-meaning people, sincere, hardworking people said, "Gee, we're having a hard..." And it was getting down to the point where it was getting hard to get people to volunteer. We had to start twisting arms behind the scenes. And it was... people started saying, "I wonder if we'll have one next year." And so, we got to 86... and Minneapolis, fabulous convention. It was a tribute to Dorothy Gish, and Lillian Gish came in for the weekend. And was there for the whole weekend. That was pretty amazing. And it was interesting. She wouldn't have come for herself, but when we said it was a tribute to Dorothy, she said, "I'll be there." And so we were asking around, and it appeared there was going to be nobody who was going to offer for 87. And so we already started, well, maybe we should skip a year. And you know, maybe we should go to every other year. And a guy, very nice guy, very sweet guy, got up at the business meeting and said, I'd like to offer Orlando, Florida. And we all looked at him and said, huh? And he said, I don't know how to do one of these. I've never put one on. I don't have anyone there to help me, but I've been coming to these for years, and I feel like I ought to do my bit, so I'd like to offer Orlando. And everyone was stunned. And I was one of the ones, I was probably the pain in the ass, who got up and said, well, that's really nice of you, but I got to ask. I mean, do you have capabilities for, do you have a theater there for 35 millimeter? No, we have no theater there for 35. I said, do you have people there who can bring in projection equipment, who can do projection? No, I don't have any of that. I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, I said, it's really nice of you to offer, but we should not be going to a place where we know we're not going to be able to pull it off. And you know, it's very sweet of you. It's very kind, very gracious. But I would strongly encourage people not to support this. And so whoever was president at the time said, does anyone else want to offer? And there was silence. And so he said, let's take a vote. You know, who wants to go to Orlando? And it was, you know, a lot of people abstained. Some people voted no, but the majority said go to Orlando. And I said, I'm going to go on record and say this is a horrible mistake. And that was my protest year. I didn't go that year. Some people went and they said, well, Orlando was a great location, but said, you're right, it really, you know, the print, you know, was 16 millimeter only. We had a very poor selection of prints. There were no stars, no 35 millimeter. It almost went back to the days of Indiana, Pennsylvania, where bring my print. And it was Orlando in Labor Day weekend, hot as blazes. I know Phil Serling described, well, the banquet wasn't a banquet because there were no stars. It was a buffet with everyone sweating into their food. I don't mean to downplay. I know how much work it is, but I just said, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. Well, then the next year, 88, was Saginaw, Wisconsin, or Saginaw, Michigan. Dennis Atkinson did it, you know, very knowledgeable guy. We had the advantage that Saginaw, which is essentially a bankrupt city, this is, you know, about the time, you know, that Roger Moore made, you know, Roger and Me, or Michael Moore made Roger and Me. About Flint, Michigan, which is not far, you know, it was an economically depressed area. We were lucky. There was a movie theater that had gone out of business, so we could take over 35. But again, they had the Mall of the Living Dead, we called it. There was a mall. It was like the mall on Saturday Night Live with Puppyland and Scotch Boutique. You know, you walk in and you walk in the store and say, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were open. Oh, no, we're open because there's nobody there. It was weird. And then 89 was Cleveland. I'm from Cleveland originally, so I'm allowed to bash Cleveland. Cleveland actually wasn't so bad. Maury Everett did it. You know, he's a paper dealer. We had a great dealer's room, but Ed Hulse had to step in and do the film program. And we did go to the Cleveland Cinematheque and have good 35s. So it was at that 89 CineCon, there was a group of us. And so we'd had 3 years that really were difficult years. They were not, you know, they were done by great people, and many of us enjoyed the events, but they were not what CineCon had come to be. And so there was actually a group of us, and it was Leonard Maltin, Randy Haberkamp, at the time was running the Silent Society, Bob Burchard, I think Dick Band might have been there, Rob McKay, and myself. And we were sitting around in, you know, somebody's hotel room saying, you know, we have to do something about this. The society cannot survive much longer, you know, if we go this way. And what happens is when you go to these remote locations, the people from the big cities who might sponsor, they don't go. And so they're not there to offer. So I think Leonard actually, and maybe it was Randy Haberkamp, Bob Burchard certainly played a major role, but I think Leonard played a major role in this, saying, you know, why don't we just move it to Hollywood permanently? And so we said, well, Leonard, you know, you have, he was now getting to be a fairly significant name. He was now on, you know, established on Entertainment Tonight. We said, Leonard, would you be the spokesperson and make the case for us to do this? You know, all the advantages, you know, we've got, you know, we can set up 35 in the hotel. We can go to like the Hollywood Roosevelt and we can get 35 millimeter projection in the hotel. So we can do all 35 programs. Guests are easy. We've got all these venues. You know, you've got the Grauman's Chinese Theater across the street. You've got the El Capitan. You've got the Egyptian. you know, we can go off to UCLA. I mean, there's tremendous venues. You know, we really should do it in Hollywood. So Leonard got up at the business meeting and made this pitch. And it was not received well. The East Coast people were very unhappy. And they said, you know, oh, this isn't fair. You know, we all used to alternate around, and you just want to cut us out, and it makes this expensive for us to go. And Leonard, who's a master, you know, from his years of show business of handling people, he said, well, I understand your concerns. I'm sympathetic. Is there somebody here who wants to offer another city for next year? Silence. And he said, okay. He said, we're offering Hollywood for the 1990 CineCon. I'm letting you know now, we're also going to offer 91. And if someone wants to come in with a competing offer for 91, we're happy to entertain them. Well, you know what happened. Yeah. I mean, we did it in Hollywood. When you're in Hollywood, the votes are overwhelming. Nobody actually did offer 91. And we did, over a short period of time, lose a lot of the East Coast members. They just stopped going. That was their protest.
Yeah.
Vote. They voted with their feet and said, no, it's not what I want to do. And by now, Syracuse was running. You still had Columbus. The Cine Sensation that Dennis Atkinson did, you know, started popping up. They had other venues, and they said, well, I'm going to skip CineCon. I can't afford it. Some of them continued coming, but so it became very much a Hollywood event, and so that's why it's been in Hollywood ever since. Now, we were at the Hollywood Roosevelt for a number of years. The Roosevelt was not what I would call a customer-friendly hotel. With the elevators were designed. You know, it's a historic 1920s hotel with historic 1920s elevators, and they were not an easy hotel to work with. And so then we had a number of years, which were not my favorite years. They moved to Glendale.
Yeah,
and it was nice, except that the theater was a mile from the hotel, and they had to run shuttle buses. You know, you could walk. It was a good long walk, and it was not a great venue, and people missed Hollywood. But we did in Glendale for several years in the late 90s, and I don't remember the exact time we moved back, but then we moved back to Hollywood when the Renaissance opened. And now you had a good hotel, and two blocks away you had the Egyptian Theater that could run almost anything. But sort of, if you want to talk about my involvement. So I was heavily involved all through the 80s. In fact, they actually gave me one of the Cinephile Awards, I think, in 83 for all my contributions. They said, you'll be behind the keyboard and behind the scenes and behind the keyboard or something like that is what the plaque says. I still have it up on my theater wall. But I continued to be involved as an advisor, and I was one of the people who was really pushing to move it to Hollywood. And of course, you can say, well, yeah, it's self-serving. I live in California now, but it really made sense. And they've been very good conventions ever since, and no one has. We even talked some years ago. Do we ever want to take a break? Take 1 year off and do it in New York City? Could never get the inertia up of someone to plan one. It was because they said, "Oh, this is, you know, it feels like Ed Hull said, you know, I can do it in New York, but heck, I like coming out here.
Yeah,
this is great." So, I was involved then. Sort of my last official involvement with CineCon. Leonard was president from 90 to 91. And then I remember we had this small group that was Leonard, myself, Randy Haverkamp, Bob Burchard, a couple other people, you know, gotten kind of working behind the scenes. And we said, well, you know, the business meeting is going to be interesting. Leonard will run the business meeting, and we're going to, and I think we'd agreed Randy Haverkamp was going to get up and make the pitch to come back in 91. We said, you know, I wonder if there's going to be an insurrection. So we had all this discussion, and we said, you know, well, we need to have a president who's got some credibility here. And Leonard just looked at me. He said, will you please be president? He said, I need to get a... He said, I did this during the transition. I've got other fish to fry. And I said, sure. So I was then the president for that second year, 91 and 92. And that was the year that we decided we began... I don't remember when we actually finalized it. I think it was after I had been president, but I may have my years wrong. We discussed becoming a formal nonprofit corporation, you know, incorporated in the state of California. And so actually we did that business meeting. It went fine. No one else proposed another city. There was a little bit of grumbling about, you know, well, why can't we go back? And again, I think Leonard was running the meeting and said, anyone else want to offer another city? Silence. And you know, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after a while.
Sure.
Because, you know, once you've established it. then the East Coast people go away, and they're the ones that would vote to move to the East Coast. And I'm sorry we lost some of those people over time, but, you know, see them at Syracuse, but it's, you know, it was just the nature of the evolution of the organization. So then we did incorporate. I'm thinking it was probably more like around 93 or 94 by the time the incorporation was finally done. And then it becomes a very different organization. In fact, the name of the organization was always the Society for Cinephiles, and I think we incorporated as the Society for Cinephiles / Cinecon Inc., and then I think they changed the incorporation paper some years later just to be Cinecon Inc., and I think that's what it is today. And so my involvement since 92 when my presidency ended has been, you know, Bob Burchard contacts me every year and says, you know, what does MoMA have in the archive that's interesting? And I pull up my database and say, you know, ooh, they've got this, you know, some of these interesting things. So every year there's a few that they, films they pick. And of course I've been playing and they sometimes ask me advice, but I'm largely now just an attendee and a performer and haven't had as much involvement. You know, film collecting was a huge thing for a while, and I don't think there are any official numbers, but certainly publications like The Big Reel that, you know, catered to film collectors who bought film, you know, they had circulation in the tens of thousands. And I know David Shepard has said, you know, a few of the very common Black Hawk titles, things like The Music Box, he said, you know, we sold, you know, more than 10,000 copies of some of these films out to collectors, which is why now if you try to sell a print of The Music Box on eBay, you don't get very much for it because, you know, the 17 people still collecting 16 millimeter film all have prints of The Music Box, and we don't need the other, you know, 9,983 copies that are circulating out there. And, but 16, you know, was very popular through the 1970s, and in about 1980, two things happened. That was the first very big nail driven into the coffin, or two nails. The first is, of course, videotape came out. You know, the Betamax is 76, VHS is, what, about 78, 79, and then there was the famous Betamax lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court where the MPPA said, you know, well, you know, this is illegal. This is a device used to record copyrighted material. Therefore, you know, we want to get an injunction and stop it. And that's when the Supreme Court handed down their very famous, you know, Fair Use Act that, you know, said, well, it's like recording tape, audio tape. It's fair use. You record something for your purposes. You can't sell it. You know, you can't, you know, make additional copies of it, but you can make a copy. And that was a big blow to the studios. Well, it didn't take them long to realize, hey, we can, you know, why should we let, you know, pirates pirate bootleg copies of these films and we can sell them? And, you know, as you know, many films survived and made money not because of the theatrical, but of the video, subsequent video sales. You know, and now we're in this rocky period where things are moving more to streaming. And yeah, just, we're going through now in film what music went through 15 or so years ago, that, you know, CDs died and, you know, were replaced by streaming. DVDs may die to some extent and be replaced by, you know, some streaming or subscription model. They'll figure out a way to make money on it. But film collecting was very big. So that was one thing. But the other thing that happened that really started the downfall was the rise in lab rates. And the reason they rose is two guys who I don't particularly care for their politics, and I didn't like them now, and I didn't like them back then, the Hunt brothers, began speculating in silver. And they engineered, essentially, a run on silver, and it drove silver prices through the roof in 1980. And silver is a significant cost of film stock. And film stock, which, there was a time there where you could print off a negative for the stock and the processing of 4 cents a foot. So, you know, a one-hour silent film, you know, 2,000 feet of film, you know, it would cost them $40 to print it. Yeah. They could sell it for $80 and make a good profit and recover the negative cost. When the Hunts began speculating in silver, it drove the price of silver up, and film stock almost tripled overnight. And by the early 1980s, it was up to 11 cents a foot. Now, today I go, wow, I would kill to get 11 cents a foot. current rates, getting ahead of myself, but that, so you had rising film costs where it's now getting more and more expensive, and I mean, you know, people were shocked, you know, Black Hawk now is charging, you know, $100 for a two-reeler. You know, oh my gosh, that just puts it out of range. You got, I killed to get a tubular for $100 today. But that combined with video, I think, was the end. And so you began quickly to see people abandoning it. And then, I mean, VHS was still not a great medium. People said, oh, the quality's much better in 16. But then when you start to move to Laserdisc,
yeah.
And, you know, Laserdiscs were around in the 70s, but really good quality Laserdiscs in the 80s, and then, you know, in the 90s, DVDs, that really was the end. And then when we began the move to digital theatrical, that's happened very quickly, faster, I think, than anyone ever thought it would, the film labs began closing. So by the mid-2000s, many of the film labs started going under. And Photochem here in Burbank is one of the last film labs left in North America. And, I mean, there's a few in Europe. I mean, and Photochem is alive only because they're cutting deals with places like the Academy and Library of Congress to do, you know, and some of the specialty houses, Film Technologies, I think Johnny Allen, are labs that cater more to archives, things like that. And they're smaller businesses. And, you know, a deal has now been cut with Kodak, where the Library of Congress has, Kodak has agreed to continue making stock for a number of years just to support the archives. Doesn't say how cheap it'll be. But I know today I do some work with Photochem. One of the things I've been doing is I've been buying up negatives because they're cheap. And people don't know what to do with them. And you see them on eBay, and you go for a song. You know, I got a negative on Return of Draw Egan, William S. Hart, for $50.
Wow.
For a really nice 16 millimeter negative. Well, unfortunately, I'm a little late. Photochem, because they feel sorry for me. I've been a good customer, and because I'm a little guy, they go, well, we can give you 29 cents a foot. That's cheaper than some other people are getting. You know, a two-reeler is, you know, $250 to print. I just printed up, I got a negative on Larry Siemens Golf, and I paid, you know, about $237 to print it up on. You know, there's not very many films I'm going to pay that kind of money for.
Sure.
And so the end is here, I think, on film labs. I just, you know, film collectors fall into, there's four and actually a fifth super category, four categories of collectors. You know, one is what I call the casual collectors. And these are the guys for years who, you know, they bought, you know, they owned a couple of Little Rascals films and maybe Laurel and Hardy, and that was it. And they would pull out the project, you know, they got a cheap projector at a camera store, and they would pull out and they'd, hey, let me show you this Little Rascals. And, ooh, isn't that cool? You've actually got film. And there were at the peak tens of thousands of those. But they weren't really collectors. They had a few knickknacks. It's like the guy who has one really nice baseball card. Category two are the guys who, you know, they collected films. You know, they really liked the films of Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin or Douglas Fairbanks, and they bought from Black Hawk, Thunderbird, Griggs, you know, Signed Service Vintage. You know, there was the small number, National Film Service, and they bought, you know, films, and they could amass a collection of hundreds of titles. Those are the people who were sort of the mainstays of Cinecon. And then, you know, you get to the category three with the hardcore. And those were the people who, you know, were seeking out Kodoscopes. They were, you know, they knew some of the film distributors. They had the under the table list. And like this, I won't name names of any collectors who are alive today, but I'll mention some dead ones. And, you know, Bob Lee ran Essex Film Club in New Jersey, and he ran Griggs Movie Drome. But Bob had access to nitrate prints from the Library of Congress and other sources, and he had a very impressive under the table list of, you know, probably 200 titles of things like He Who Gets Slapped, The Unholy Three, you know, Don Juan, an impressive, you know, copyrighted motion pictures that, you know, if you knew Bob and were friends with him, he would sell. So the third category, they were picking up those, and they would find used Kodoscopes. And then there's the fourth category, and those are the crazy people. And I'm sorry to say I'm in that group. And those are the people who would cut deals with Library of Congress or Eastman House to get a nitrate print, get into a lab, strike a negative, and then do trade deals. That's the truly obsessive. And I regret to say I fall in that group. But I, as an example, I really wanted to get a print on The Scarlet Car with Lon Chaney. And which would essentially complete the Library of Congress. And I had done some favors for the American Film Institute, who at that time was the sort of the portal to get films into the Library of Congress. And I'd actually done a a negative on the road demand delay, the Lanchenium gem. It was a 9.5 millimeter European print, and I did a blow up. There are only two labs in the world that would do blow ups 9.5. I did a blow up, which is pretty expensive. Had French titles. I had all new titles shot. David Shepard taught me how to cut negatives. He set me up at the Directors Guild with a good hot splicer, and I cut it together. You know, struck some prints, and then I sold the negative to MGM because they had essentially no material, and so I broke even on the deal. But then I had a print and I donated it to the Library of Congress. In exchange, they agreed to strike me a neg of the Scarlet Car off the nitrate. So they sent the nitrate to Film Technology, which is a top lab, and then I got it and realized that a reel was missing because one of the nitrate reels had decomposed. So then they sent the safety reel out, and we did that, and I cut it together. So that's, those are the kind of crazy projects that I've done over the years. I would say there's, and in that category four, I mean, there's a pretty small number. People like Rusty Castleton is a well-known name. He passed away a number of years ago and who had many negatives. There's a super category of that I think has three names in it, and that's and those are the category five. Those are the gods, and that's David Shepard. Well, there's probably four. David Shepard, who of course you still to this day is putting out many many things on DVD and yeah. Doing a lot of official releases of some wonderful films, and you know David should be sainted. And Kevin Brownlow, of course, Kevin was an enormous collector, but he did have a lot of interesting stuff. And of course, he's well known for things like Napoleon, but has, you know, done so much more work. William K. Everson and Bill had about 4,000 films. And then David Bradley, not as well known a name, but David had about 10,000 films. David probably had the largest private film collection, ever. And David is interesting. David is well known for two things. He is credited as the guy who discovered Charlton Heston and actually cast Charlton Heston in for, you know, he was an independent director.
Yeah.
He did films. He's also infamous as the director of They Saved Hitler's Brain. He actually didn't direct They Saved Hitler's Brain. He was making a different movie, I think called The Mad Men of Madeiros was the name. I don't recall the circumstances. The project was either taken away from him or he ran out of funding, and then they picked up his unfinished footage, recut it, re-edited it, and turned it into They Saved Hitler's Brain, and released it with him credited as the director. He'd never even seen the film until the 1980s, and then he finally saw it. He said, wow, he said, in language I can't use on your podcast, he said, that really is a, you know, piece of junk. But David came from a family with money. He lived right over here in Laurel Canyon. And his family had money, so he was independently wealthy. And after World War II, when he was a young man, as the story goes, he wandered Europe going into kind of decimated towns, you know, been destroyed by bombing and had economic hardship, and buying up their film libraries for pennies on the dollar. And so he had a very impressive collection of foreign. He had a tremendous amount of French and German films. But also he was taught at UCLA for a while. And he had access to the UCLA archives, so he was doing negatives off of nitrates. So he had a very impressive collection of negatives. David was a very interesting guy. He liked me a lot. He liked my playing. And he you know, I always talk like this. Everything David said was, you know, sounded like a bulldog growling. He was actually a very sweet guy, if you were on his good side. But, you know, his typical example, after I played some film, he used to do shows at the Pacific Film Archive, and he'd bring films up, and I usually played them, and he came up to me, he says, well, you're a regular frickin' Paderewski, aren't you? Except he didn't say frickin'. So I traded with David as well, and got some, you know, amazing stuff through him. But those guys, they sort of sit in their own orbit.
Well, now do you have your own vault, or what do you?
Well, so I'm that's a separate problem. I'm running out of space, and I guess you know one maybe the last thing I'll mention on collecting is so I've recently done a deal, and it's a complicated confidential deal, so I can't tell you the terms for the collection of the late Gordon Burkow. Gordon was a legendary collector. In fact, in the early days of the Syracuse Cinefest. He provided many of the prints. He was an attorney, you know, a well-to-do attorney, and he began collecting in the 1950s as a young man. And he had amassed an enormous collection. He also, although he was an attorney by day, he taught film history at Rutgers and one other school I don't recall. And so he had amassed a very large collection. It had a lot of what I would call common film history fare, you know, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Open City, Rashomon type films. But he had about 300 tinted original Kodoscope prints. So Gordon passed away in 2004, and I won't go through all the gory legal details. The collection sat for an extended period of time while the family was figuring out what to do with it. And for a while, David Packard had expressed interest. He never really came through, couldn't do anything. There's about the official inventory, which is not entirely correct, as I'm learning, is about 2,150 titles, but 450 features, and the rest is shorts. So to make a long story short, after languishing for years, I know it was sitting, they were paying a significant amount for air-conditioned storage, about $300 a month for 10 years, to store the films. With no other deals happening, I was approached by the family. A couple of mutual friends said, you ought to talk to John Marsalis. And they approached me in April of this year, and by the end of May, we had done a deal. And the collection shipped, and it's now sitting in my theater. I don't have a theater anymore, because it's... In fact, it was interesting rehearsing for Lilac Time. I set up my keyboard. I had no place for the keyboard, so I had to, like, move piles around just to squeeze the keyboard into the middle of the room so that I could just practice a little. I'm probably only going to keep less than 10% of the collection. I mean, there is some extraordinary stuff in there. But as part of the financial terms, I need to raise money on it. So I'm going to be selling about 90% of it. So I actually have auctions that ending on eBay right now as we speak. I'm sending out some lists to private collectors who are helping me out, taking some things, and then I'm going to sell sort of the mere dregs, the print of Hell's Angels that has all the color footage in it, is an auction that's ending on eBay today or tomorrow. And so I'm going through, but in going through that collection, there's at least a dozen features that don't exist in any film archive. So I've been talking to the Library of Congress. I was back there a few weeks ago for the Mostly Lost Festival. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking with the Library of Congress folks, and they are now set up to do high def. I think they're doing 4K scans. And no one has the resources anymore to do, you know, proper film preservation on everything that comes along. And so on the rare things, before even some of it, you know, and I'm sorry for those listening, you know, there is no 40 Real Greed, London After Midnight, or the case of Lena Smith in there. You know, these are 1926 Chadwick productions and Chesterfields and Duke Warney and, you know, Ben Wilson productions. They're obscure films, things like The Sunshine of Paradise Alley, Chadwick 1926, or The Rustler's End, Ben Wilson production. And so before I part company with those are all going to the Library of Congress, where they're setting up and they're going to be scanning. So I've been working with LOC to try to make sure that, you know, I mean, many of the collectors these are going to, these are people that we know we can get at them for festivals. In fact, I'm going out of my way to make sure that the rare stuff does go to people who I know will cooperate. There's a few people I know who aren't cooperative, and I'm not going to sell to them. You know, they can bid on the dregs on eBay, but I'm not going to sell to them because I want these things to be seen.
Yeah.
So Niles has taken some. Again, you know, other guy, I won't name any names here because there are people who are alive, but many people who've been on your podcast, actually, in various forms, are taking, you know, have taken films. But I'm slowly, it's going to take me about a year and a half, is my estimate, to go through. And, you know, the common things, you know, the Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, I put them up on the screen, I look at 3 minutes, I say, oh, you know, nice original print, you know, some lines, few slices in the opening, and I put them on eBay, and they're going. And there still are collectors for those things. In fact, I've been selling quite a bit overseas. In fact, I'm at auctions ending last week, and I sold one to print to Czechoslovakia, one to Switzerland, and one to Belgium. And there's a collector in Japan who only buys Fox directors. So, you know, he'll buy John Ford, Frank Borzage, Raoul Walsh. And so, you know, when you have a What Price Glory, you know, that's I know where that's going to go. So, and of course, the cream of the crop I'm keeping for myself. He also, Gordon, Herb Graff, and Bill Everson had purchased together, had gone in on the Robert Youngson collection. So they have all of Youngson's originals. So I'm going through and I'm finding original prints on many things. You know, Youngson would cut a deal with the studio, who would go to the camera negative and strike a camera negative, you know, print down of, wow, of a two-reel Hal Roach short that he would then use for his compilation. So I'm finding some of those things in there as well. So I'm going to make sure these all get a good home. The things that are rare, I'm making sure that there is good preservation material on these. And we're also, I mean, I guess I don't think this is secret. I think I can divulge this. Library of Congress is starting a project where they're going to be doing more online streaming, and they've actually just recently cut a deal with myself and some other accompanists to start doing scores
for
online release. And so moving forward, they had some end-of-year money that they wanted to allocate for the end of the government fiscal year at the end of September, and they're going to be setting them up. People are going to be scoring them, you know, just not fancy, you know, one take, do in my basement, score. And I don't know who else they've signed. I know they've talked to Phil Carley and Ben Modell and Andrew Simpson and a couple other people about doing this. I think they have probably agreed. And so a number of us will be, you know, scoring films that LSC is going to start streaming from their archive. And so some of these digital scans, I'm giving them free rein to do whatever they want with them in terms of release. I'm not asking for any kind of rights or payback, because I know there is no money to be gotten.
Sure.
I mean, you can't, you know, it's like in my science day job, I work on cures for malaria. You know, we don't even patent malaria drugs because you can't make any money selling malaria drugs, because the only people who have it are poor.
Yeah.
And so the few of us, you know, you're the big double-digit numbers of your listeners to your podcast, you know, they're all interested in this stuff, but, you know, we don't have enough to do a Blu-ray release. The things that I have an enormous pile that is, you know, probably about 6 stacks of cans 5 feet high, that's my want-to-watch list. And that I'm going to go through one at a time. And those are going to be coming later. So the early stuff is the common stuff, and I'm saving the good stuff for last. And also some of the very rare things, I need to get it to Library of Congress, have them scan it, get it back. So there are probably some months before those. So that's what I said. I'm looking at this, it'd be about a year and a half.
Wow.
Process.
It's like a full-time job in and of itself.
Every evening I go down and I screen the first few minutes of, you know, 4 or 5 titles, and then I usually, you know, might watch a feature, watch a short. And then, you know, I do 7 a night. And at that rate, I'll get through everything in a little over a year.
Yeah. Well, our time is growing short, so let's switch gears a little bit. As we know you as a fine musician, but you're also a film historian. And I wondered, over all those years of CineCon and you're meeting all these celebrities, were you ever making a point to interview them?
So the answer is yes. And a few of them have had, interesting, I made a little list here of stars that I've performed for. I always get a kick out of, you know, performing for a silent film with the star sitting in the audience. And just off the top of my head, it's Lillian Gish, Blanche Sweet, Billy Dove, Priscilla Bonner, Patsy Ruth Miller, Esther Ralston, George O'Brien, and Colleen Moore. And I was showing you last night, I have autographed by Colleen, you know, to John, who made my film come alive with his music, you know, autographed Lilac Time sheet music. And I was showing that around, this is your eat your heart out moment.
Sure.
To people last night. So, yes, I have had chances. I mean, there have been a few stars that I've become very friendly with over the years. Certainly Esther Ralston, Mary Bryan, Loretta Young, Billy Dove, are people I've spent multiple visits with multiple times. I've set up, you know, microphones and interviewed. I have a very lengthy interview with Loretta Young that I did, back in mid-80s. But I want to tell you that my before we get into that, it's related, but my 3 favorite CineCon star stories, because it's sort of related how I got to meet stars. And a lot of these, you know, I met through CineCon, and then they'd hear me play, and then we'd make a connection through that. But my 3 favorite stories, in order. In 1990, when the first year in Hollywood, everyone said, oh, you know, this has to be just a knockout convention. This has to be spectacular. You know, we want to do just amazing things. And so everyone pulled out all the stops. What can we do? And so I can't take credit for what I'm about to tell you, but it was one of those great, but it was in the context of the what can we do moment. So one of the guests was Jackie Cooper. And, you know, we had a, ran a film, you know, one of his rare MGMs, and we did a great Q&A, and I heard Jackie Cooper in 1990. He was still a relatively youngish man and
sure.
very alert and articulate. And he told great stories. And as we were getting near the end of the time, he said, I got to tell you, though, he said, I owe everything to Hal Roach. Hal Roach gave me a start, but when I had great opportunities to go to MGM, I was under contract, and Hal Roach tore up my contract. And he actually got teary-eyed. I mean, you could hear him choking up a little. And he said, so, you know, I wouldn't be where I am today if Hal Roach hadn't mentored me, nurtured me, and given, you know, and then let me go. And we said, and, you know, this very moving, kind of touching moment. Yeah. And so we say, and I don't know if you were there or know what's coming, and we said, well, Jackie, you know, thank you. Our time's up. We want to present you with our annual Cinephile Award. Here to present it is Hal Roach. And Dick Bann helps in 97 or 98-year-old Hal Roach. Every jaw in the place is on the floor. People are just speechless. Not a dry eye in the house. Hal Roach comes up, still, you know, just all totally on, you know, loud, you know, yeah, I'm, you know, 97, 98, don't I look great? And presented the word Jackie Cooper, just an unbelievable moment. That's one of those, you know,
sure.
great, great moments, Cinecon. So I said, so then I was president for next year, you know, and I, again, I was involved in the program, but I said, how the heck are you going to top that? What are you going to do to top that? And so people were scratching their heads. And, of course, Marvin Page, who passed away recently, knew a lot of stars. And so the next year, one of the honorees was Linwood Dunn. Of course, last night we presented at the show at the Linwood Dunn Theater at the Academy. You know, and Linwood Dunn, you know, well-known for developing the optical printing process that, you know, the first major film was used on was King Kong. You know, that was the only way to get, you know, Fay Wray cowering on the ground while Kong battles a T-Rex behind it with optical printing. Up to that point, everything had to be done in camera, and that wasn't going to be done in camera. And so, you know, he did this great Q&A, and he talked about the process and the invention, how he did it, and he talked about, you know, the stuff they had invented for King Kong. And he said, here to present your award is Fay Wray. And Fay Wray comes in looking fabulous, by the way. We tried to get her as a guest for years, but got her to come in for, you know, to present this to Linwood Dunn. And Fay Wray comes in, you know, again, every jaw hanging open. In the theaters, just an incredible moment. And she breezed in, breezed out. But years later, I got to actually meet her and spend time with her when she was a guest at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. And I was one of the accompanists, and I got invited to the private party that she was at. And I just walked up to her, and I said, I want to introduce you. I said, we met very briefly when you were at Cinecon several years ago. But I said, we didn't have a chance to talk. And that's the year I was president, so I kind of went along and someone took a very out-of-focus, too dark picture of us together. But now I have a great picture of us together. But I told her the story. I said, you know, it all started when I was 4 years old when I saw King Kong, and that, you know, changed my life. I said, so you are, you know, you are one of the reasons that probably one of the main reasons that I am here now doing this. But my all-time favorite Cinecon story, one of the stories I'll take to my grave, is 1979. George O'Brien comes to Cinecon, and you were there.
I was there.
You
yeah.
remember this moment. And, you know, George O'Brien, you know, big silent star at Fox. But once he got into sound, he was mostly a Western star. I mean, he spent most of his sound career doing Westerns, with a few exceptions. And for years, the Western film festivals, and yes, there are Western film festivals, they would always invite him, and he, nah, not interested. So Etta Hulse was doing the 79 Cinecon. He called and he said, we're going to be running a 35mm print of Sunrise at Museum of Modern Art. We'd love to have you as our guest. He said, I'll be there. And he came for the whole weekend, and I got to play, I think, Three Bad Men, The Dancers, and some of his other films. But we got him into MoMA, and we were going to run MoMA's 35 of Sunrise. You know, a film we had all seen many times. And so he came in. And he was sitting in the back. He kind of, you know, didn't want to be up front or anything. He was just sitting in either the back row or next to last row. And we ran the film. Of course, most of us had seen Sunrise. And, you know, but it still was emotionally draining experience to see it. And at the end of the film, totally unrehearsed, no one prompted to do this. Everyone in the audience stood up, turned around, and gave him a standing ovation. And big, tough, He-Man George O'Brien was sitting in the back row with tears running down his cheek. So, you know, that's one of those moments from CineCon. You just, you know, you can't get that anywhere else. You just, you take that moment to your grave. So, but other stars, I have interviewed, you know, other stars. I mean, I know we're getting low on time here, but I mean, just a couple highlights. I got to spend almost an entire week with Frank Capra when I was in graduate school. It was one of the very first ones. We had a very good student film program. We had probably one of the top. I think it was the second highest budgeted student film program in any university in America when I was at North Carolina State. And we would bring somebody in every year, and we brought in Frank Capra for a week. And so I was running the student film program. We programmed films the week before. So the week before he came, we were running, you know, things like State of the Union, and It Happened One Night. And then the week that he was there, I was one of the hosts who got to escort him around. And it was interesting because he was going to do three shows to the public, and he wanted to pick the films. And so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night, he said, well, I want to pick the films. We said, you know, and this is 1976. We said, okay, what films do you want to run? He said, well, Monday night, let's do Bitter Tea of General Yen. And I said, ooh, I've heard of this. You know, the controversial film because it's about, you know, interracial, you know, romance, you know, with Barbara Stanwyck and Nils Astrup, who's a Swede, but he's a Chinaman. And it was banned in some states. I said, oh, I've heard about this. I always want to see it. You know, Tuesday night, I want to do Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Oh, classic Americana. You know, I think it's probably Capra's best film. You know, great picture. That's great. He said, Wednesday night, I want to do It's a Wonderful Life. And we all looked at each other and said, what's that? Nobody had heard of it. And we're all going to our books looking it up. And I said, it's some Jimmy Stewart film. Wonder why he wants to run this. Completely unknown film. It had just gone into the public domain in 1973. The only way people were seeing it is what Capra was taking around to college campuses.
Yeah.
So imagine an audience that has never seen it, and it was packed because, you know, he was a big deal when he was there, and they loved the earlier shows. And we'd stirred up, we had done articles in the student paper. I wrote, you know, a bunch of articles for the paper. And so imagine an audience of 600 people who've never heard of It's a Wonderful Life and seeing it for the first time. That's impressive. But the thing about Capra, and I know, you know, you've talked about Capra, and you know, I love his autobiography. It is, I wouldn't call it, you know, complete lies.
No.
It is, he, as we all do, he spins history the way he remembers it and the way he wants it to be remembered.
Sure.
There are certainly exaggerations. There's lots of kernels of wisdom and truth in there. I mean, I know Harry Langdon fans think, you know, it's out and out lies. But let's be honest. When Langdon fired Capra, he never made another good movie in his career.
Yeah.
Langdon didn't know what to do with himself. And no one else did either. And so Capra, while he overinflates his role for creating the character, Capra knew what to do with it.
Yeah.
And others didn't, and Langdon certainly didn't. But anyway, Capra, we learned that when he did Q&A, and he did in the student film class, he did all sorts of stuff, and so he did lots of Q&A, and I was there for all of it. What I found, though, is every question he answered, he would answer with a passage from his book. And he'd obviously told the story so many times, and I remember I was sitting with my girlfriend at the time, and I had the book with me, because it eventually got him to autograph it. And he would start a story, and I'm thinking, I know where that is, and I'd flip to the book, and I'd be following off word for word in the book. So we got nothing new that wasn't in the book, with one exception. I asked the question that wasn't in the book. And I got a spontaneous answer, and it surprised me. He said, and I said, of all the great people, you know, you've worked with the best. You know, you work with, you know, Gable, Claudette Colbert, Barbara Stanwyck, Jimmy Stewart, you know, Katharine Hepburn, you know, you, Spencer Tracy, you rattle off this list. I said, is there any major star you always wanted to work with and didn't? And he didn't pause for a microsecond. He just said, James Cagney.
Hmm.
I said, really? James Cagney? He said, yeah. He said, I wanted to work with Cagney so badly. And I tried and tried to get him away from Warner Brothers, and I could never do a deal that could get him. And I said, why Cagney? He said, Cagney was the only male actor who could make me cry. I thought that was such an interesting comment. He said, Cagney, there was something about Cagney that this visceral quality in his films, and you'd get into a dramatic scene, he said, and I would weep watching Cagney. He said, always wanted to work with him, never could. That's the only response I ever got that wasn't his book. So, I mean, I guess I know we're running out of time. I mean, a couple other stories. I got to spend a day with Blanche Sweet. She came in for a festival in North Carolina, of all places, and we ran Anna Christie and The Sporting Venus. But I got, you know, I went to dinner with her, spent some time, and, you know, and of course, she worked with Ronald Colman, and she did one film with Lon Chaney. And Colman and Chaney are two of my favorites. She had virtually no recollections of anything Chaney did.
Wow.
But she did talk about the Colman pictures. It was interesting. But so she was interesting. But another one that I spent a lot of time with was Billy Dove. And again, a lot of these people I met through Rob McKay. Rob has a knack for getting in to meet actors and actresses. He just has the right demeanor, and he knows how to approach them. And he had provided some. He had written Billy Dove and mentioned that he had one of her rare films. It was Cock of the Walk, one of the Howard Hughes pictures. And she said, oh, I'd love to see that. So we arranged to get a video transfer, sent it to her. And she said, well, you have to come visit me next time you're down. So we go down, and so we visited her many times. She lived in the Thunderbird Country Club in Rancho Mirage, you know, just outside of Palm Springs. But my two great Billy Dove stories to tell, and Billy was great because she would mention Ruby Keeler in passing. She says, oh, Ruby lives around the corner. And we said, well, we'd love to meet her. So, well, next time you come, we'll go to lunch. And so we went to lunch with Billy Dove and Ruby Keeler. I have a great picture of me taken with the two of them. And three houses down from her is Alice Faye. And so you have these people. But my two great Billy Dove stories is she had a room full of memorabilia. Really impressive. And she would let us rummage around. She had, like, key sets on many of her pictures, you know, complete key sets of all the photographs from The Black Pirate, you know, which were, like, these tinted, or, you know, they weren't color photographs, but they were, like, sepia-toned or in tinted pictures, many stuff. But Rob McKay is digging through, and he finds a telegram, and he goes, holy cow, what is this? And he brings it out. He says, what is this? And it's a telegram. It said, want you for Belle Watling for Gone with the Wind. Please call DOS. And she said, oh, yeah, Dave Selznick wanted me to do Belle Watling in Gone with the Wind. And I said, seriously? She said, yeah. She said, you know, I mean, I was married at the time, and I had retired and didn't want to do it. So, but can you imagine Billy Dove as Belle Watling in Gone with the Wind? But my other great story, again, to show you that these are people that move in very different orbits from us. The next time we went down to visit her, it was very different now, and there were cameras looking at us, and we had to speak into an intercom just to drive into the whole complex. There were security gates, and I said, and, you know, we had to introduce ourselves. You know, we're here, last name is Keniston, we're here to see Mrs. Keniston. And just a minute, and, you know, we're waiting a couple minutes, and okay, you know, please drive directly to her house. Do not, you know, go anywhere else. You know, we'll expect, you know, you to be at her house in 3 minutes. Okay. That's kind of weird. So we drove in, and, you know, we get in. She said, did you have trouble getting in? I said, well, no, but security seems a lot higher. She says, yeah, it's gotten a lot tighter since Jerry moved in. I said, Jerry? She said, yeah, Jerry Ford. He's my next-door neighbor. So President Gerald Ford moved in and was her next-door neighbor. Lived right on the golf course. We knew Mary Carlisle very well. You know, of course, Mary's well-known. She was Bing Crosby's first leading lady and, you know, did a lot of films at Paramount in the 30s. And her husband was Jim Blakely, who had a minor starring role in the 30s. But they both came from socialite families. In fact, Mary's mother, I think, had remarried Henry Kaiser. So they lived in, like, the 500 block of Rodeo Drive. And they were these two socialites who also happened to be in film. Jim Blakely continued in post-production. I think he taught post-production at UCLA, and he was working in his 80s. Doing post-production on films. But Mary had, we were in town, and Mary said, I'd like to have you guys over for a dinner party. And she had a dinner party. It was Mary and her husband, Sally Blaine, Loretta Young's sister, who was a star in her own right, Mary Bryan, and Billy Bakewell from All Quiet on the Western Front. And they had us over for a dinner party. And I remember we brought clips along. We had clips showing, you know, bloopers that, you know, Sally Blaine, we had some clips of everybody. But at dinner, you know, the wine was flowing and they were, you know, the talk was getting pretty loose. And Sally Blaine started talking about how Loretta, she said, yeah, she said, you know, I never understood. Loretta was crazy about Arthur Lake. I said, Arthur Lake? Dagwood? Arthur Lake? Yeah, Arthur Lake. She said, She said, I just thought it was the silliest thing, but she would just sit there making cow eyes when she was about 18, 19 years old at Arthur Lake. And then she said, a loud voice, she slammed her fist down the table. She says, I believe Arthur Lake was the only woman that Loretta ever loved. She says, and I'm including her husband. And it's just, you know, we all were just, wow. And, you know, if Sally hadn't had two or three glasses of wine, I doubt we would have gotten that story. But that was a good one. I did know Loretta very well. And I interviewed her about Ronald Coleman. I interviewed her about Lon Chaney. Lots of good material on that. My other fun story about Loretta is that she, we would go visit her. You know, she lived off of Ambassador Drive in Beverly Hills and would, and so we were talking and she was telling us, and she was very articulate, and she was a very strong woman. I mean, she told the story in detail about how she went to war with, I think it was MCA, over the Loretta Young TV show rights, and she had the rights to all of them, and she won a legal battle. And I just mentioned passing. I said, you know, I've never seen any of your TV shows. She said, really? I said, well, you know, when they were on TV, I said, you know, little boys didn't watch the Loretta Young show. I said, you know, I'd love to see them now. They're not available. Later they did. She kept them off of video for a long time because she was afraid that people would think she looked silly with all the costumes she did. And later she relented and they have come out. But she said, oh, I have to show you one. And so she pulled out one. I think it's called The Portrait. It was a very good show. It was about, you know, a woman who's horribly disfigured on one side of her face, and this painter is painting her good side and never sees the other side. He falls in love with her without being able to see this horribly disfigured face. Well, but the fun part of the story is we're about 5 minutes in, and she says, oh, darn, I have to go to Mass. And she's very religious. She went to, like, 5 o'clock Mass. She says, I got to go. And we said, you know, it's okay. We'll leave. You know, and she said, no. She said, go ahead. Keep watching. Just lock the door on the way out. And she races out the door and leaves us alone in her home with her Oscars and her Emmys sitting there. And you know, I'm a little uncomfortable about that. So we went to finish watching the show and I said, you know, let's get out of here. You know, I can just picture Beverly Hills police coming and shooting two young guys, leaving Loretta Young's vacant house. But as I'm putting the tape back on the shelf, I see this thing that says Studio Home Movies. I go, huh. I just pop in the VCR, and my jaw drops. It's movies shot on the set of some of her films, and I recognize Bulldog Drummond Strikes Back. And I thought, holy geez. So yeah, said, I got to ask her about this next time, so we put it back. So the next time we go back, she says, I noticed you had this videotape here. What is that? She goes, oh, that old thing. She said, you know, She said, I was an amateur cinematographer. And she said, that was one of my hobbies. I shot home movies. And she said, I sometimes took my camera in and on the set. And she said, what I'd do when I was doing a scene, she said, I would flutter my eyes at the second unit cameraman and say, oh, sweetie, would you please film us while we're shooting this scene? And she said, he would do yes. She said, so I've got about, 40 minutes of footage shot on films. I said, oh, wow, I'd like to see that videotape. She says, well, you know, I have the 16mm film in the garage. You want to borrow it and copy it? So we borrowed these and ran reversals on it. I don't know what happened to that film footage now. I think it's possible it's been donated to the Academy, but I have the reversal footage of that. So we brought it back, this black and white, this amazing stuff shot on the set of Bulldog Drummond Strikes Back, Clive of India. I can't remember some of the other ones. You know, it's astonishing stuff. I mean, anyway, so they're shooting with Loretta Young and Charles Boyer, and this is all silent footage. And then we walk, and then Loretta steps off, and then the cast all changes, and we realize that's Annabella. I said, they're shooting the French language version. They're bringing in a French cast with Boyer, and they're now shooting the French language version, which Annabella did the Loretta Young part. You know, isn't that interesting?
Wow.
That footage. So we bring that back, and we said, well, here, we want to return these. You know, thank you so much. This is great. She said, you want the color footage now. I said, the color footage? She said, so she has, you know, about, not quite as much, but maybe about 30 minutes of Kodachrome from the 30s and 40s. And she has, like, her honeymoon in Waikiki in 1937. She has, you know, I mean, it's now common knowledge, wasn't discussed back then, that, you know, her daughter, she had an illegitimate daughter by Clark Gable,
sure,
Judy Lewis. And, in fact, I think Wellman was the one who said, you know, well, you know, it was cold up there on location, and they were two young, good-looking people, and it's kind of lonely, and one thing led to another. And, you know, and she went to Europe, took a year off, you know, making four films a year, and suddenly there's this gap around 1936, 37, and she came back and she said, look at this lovely baby I adopted in Europe. But anyway, but she had pictures of her with the baby in 1937. And so anyway, so I have color copies of all
wow.
that as well. So just the astonishing stuff. So that was with Loretta. Through Rob McKay, I got to meet Elizabeth Allen. And we were actually over in England. And I had a scientific conference I was going to in France, and Rob said, "Oh, you know, I've never been to France, and I speak reasonably good French." And he said, "You know, I'm always afraid to go to France because I don't speak any French." And he said, "I'll make a deal with you. If you'll show me around Paris, I'll show you around England." And you know, so we had tea with Anna Neagle, who
wow.
Rob knew, but we went down to Brighton & Hove and spent an afternoon with Elizabeth Allen. And Liz was told probably the most amazing stories of any star I ever met. I mean, just the very, she was very open, not reserved at all, just told it all. And she knew such amazing people. And the thing about Liz is, so, you know, she was the go-to beautiful blonde British starlet. When MGM needed someone for, you know, a British blonde for Tale of Two Cities or David Copperfield, they went to Liz. But she was married to a guy, I think his name was Bill O'Brien. Last name was O'Brien. I think it was Bill O'Brien, who was a very powerful theatrical booking agent. He was like the Michael Ovitz of the 30s. And so he was very powerful and influential and then had this beautiful wife, so they knew everybody. And she told amazing stories about people, and she was friends with the absolute top group of people that you'd be interested in. But her house was amazing. But she had a picture on her wall just to show you the truly different galactic orbits these people are in. And I looked at this picture and I said, "Oh my gosh, what is this?" And she goes, oh, that was one of our dinner parties. And I look at this picture and it's Bill and her it's Liz and her husband, Gary Cooper, Marlena Dietrich, John Gilbert, a couple other people. And she was very close to Gilbert, and she said, you know, Marlena was, you know, she says, you know, Marlena was not very good for Judd. She didn't care for Marlena much. She said they hung out together, but she said, "I didn't approve of some of the things she did." And she said that, you know, Gilbert had a cocaine problem. And she said, you know, once, you know, she went to kiss John on the cheek, and she said, "Oh, you know, did you come from the dentist?" And he said, "No." And she said, the smell reminded her of the dentist, because she said she realized she thought it was Novocaine. Then she realized it was cocaine. She says, "You know, Marlena was not very good for John." She said, "Yeah, Marlena broke up, you know, or nearly broke up a lot of marriages." And she said, "You know, she almost broke up Joel McRae and Frances D." And I said, "Oh, I've never heard this. I didn't know she had an affair with McRae." She says, "No, with Frances."
Ah.
Well, next time you see Blood Money, you know, put that image in your mind. But this picture, it's all these amazing people. All these stars. There were a couple others I don't remember. And there was a guy I didn't recognize. Didn't look like Hollywood. And I said, "Who's this?" She said, "Oh, that's just Rock." Rock. She said, "Yeah, you know, he used to come to parties. He used to play for us." Rock. She said, "Yeah, you know, Sergei Rachmaninoff." Rock.
Rock.
And I'm a huge Rachmaninoff fan. I said, "Sergei Rachmaninoff played piano at your dinner parties with Marlena Dietrich, John Gilbert, Gary Cooper." She said, "Oh, yeah, he used to come over all the time." And I'm just thinking, you know, I'm in a different solar system here. So anyway, so that's that. I could go on, you know, to the Dorothy Lee meeting, Edwige Fouliere in Paris, you know, a lot of time with Mary Bryan, who was married to George Tomasini, who was Hitchcock's film editor, and their house had all his golden, you know, the Golden Scissors Awards for Psycho, North by Northwest, Rear Window, things like that. And, you know, she told amazing stories about I will tell you one last Mary Bryan story. I know we're going on forever, but Mary was performing with the USO during World War II, and they were traveling around and entertaining the troops, just usually not far off from where the battle were. And she said there was one night where this like major colonel who was in charge of them. He said, wake up, get up. And she said, what? Are you, know, we under attack? You know, no, it's okay, but there's something you need to see this. And he didn't know. He said it wasn't even light yet. And they shuttled him onto jeeps and they ran him up to a hilltop where she said she watched the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow.
and, you know, from a distance, but he said, you know, this is a major offensive, and you you ought to see this. So, you know, you get to watch. So those are the kind of stories Mary Bryan told. They told stories about Hitchcock sitting around the kitchen table after dinner with George talking about how they were going to cut Psycho. And so, you know, again, she was another one that I visited her a lot, and you know, she was a real sweetheart. I think we probably run out of it. I could do a whole another podcast.
We will do another
maybe
one.
We will someday.
Yes, part three will come next year. We'll do it again. I really appreciate it. This has been so much fun listening to your tales, and enjoyed so much listening to you play last night. So it's
and if you run this before the CineCon in 2 weeks, we can make a plug to come to the 50th CineCon. It'll be a big event. And, you know,
I will.
50 is a big, big, important number. And, I've heard some people who have not gone for some years are coming back, to do it. So I think it'll be a great, great show.
Good. Well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Frank.
A lot of great stuff from John Marsalis, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I had a great time, although, as you could hear, I barely say anything throughout. I was beaming and listening and enjoying the talk very much. So I hope that we'll have John back again, because he's got even more and better stories to tell. I won't say better stories. That makes it sound like this one is just a lead up to the next one. He's got more stories of this caliber to tell. So we'll probably do it next year, maybe around CineCon time again. And speaking of CineCon, is coming up on Labor Day weekend. I hope that you will come. There's lots of interesting stuff playing, and stuff that isn't incredibly rare, but that you don't get to see all that often. And one of the ones I'm most excited about seeing again is Buck Benny Rides Again, with Jack Benny and Eddie Rochester Anderson and the whole crew. And it is a truly wonderful, funny film. And I've always thought of it as a kind of subversive move on Benny's part to set up a starring role for Rochester Anderson in an era that wouldn't necessarily have put him in the lead in an A picture like that. And it works out beautifully. Jack Benny is in it plenty, of course, but Rochester really steals the focus of this movie, and he sings, he dances, he's a great dancer, and it's a delightful movie. So if you'd come for nothing else than that, but there's also incredibly rare silent films and early sound films, and there'll be a celebrity or two on hand. Not so many from the silent movie days anymore, because, you know, they're not available. But Margaret O'Brien will be there. There's no scoffing at Margaret O'Brien. She's the real thing. So, and let me, most important of all, Dawn Moore, the daughter of Clayton Moore, and I will be doing a program devoted to the 100th birthday of her father, Clayton Moore. And we will show some clips, and we will talk about her dad, and we will maybe take some audience questions, although that's usually a horrible idea, but we might do it. And we have a couple of other guests who are pretty much confirmed, but are not definitely confirmed. So we will wait and see before I make any real solid announcement about that. But there might be two more, and one of them has a hilarious story about Clayton Moore that he has told on the David Letterman show on more than one occasion. And if that ain't a clue, I don't know how to give you a clue, but we're waiting for him to solidly say, yes, he's definitely coming. And right now he's saying, 90% going to be there, but we will see. In the meantime, please visit the website, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. You can sample all the other podcast that we've done. Now 70 of them so far. Is that something? That's not even counting the bonus episodes. And then we're up to 16 radio movies podcasts. So we've just changed the website a little bit, and I wanted to alert you to it just in case it proves at all confusing. When you go to thecommentarytrack.com, on the front page, on the toolbar, you'll see link that says podcasts. When you click on that, it will give you an option to go to the commentary track or to radio movies. So depending on what you want to get to, click on one of those. When you have done so, I wish you would subscribe to the commentary track, and both of them come under that heading on iTunes, but I wish you would subscribe to the commentary track podcast on iTunes. And once you have done that, or even if you don't do it, leave a nice review. Say how much you love this podcast and give it 5-star rating, and that'll help spread the word. And to help support the podcast, if you would go through the Amazon link on the commentarytrack.com page and buy everything that you're ever going to buy from Amazon through that link on my web page, then I'll get a little percentage back from Amazon, and that'll help us rolling. You could also actually contribute to the website, as the great Ryan Fowler just did this week, gave a contribution to help us keep the lights on, and I laud him and praise him and offer him the hearty hand grasp of friendship. So thank you, Ryan. And lots more of you out there should be looking in the mirror and saying, should I be more like Ryan Fowler? Yes, you should. You should all be more like Ryan Fowler and do as Ryan does. Thanks to my wonderful wife, Clara McCullough, the announcer on the commentary track and on Radio Movies. Thanks to James Hutchins for designing my website and for recently helping me to create that second page to make sure that the Radio Movies and the commentary track don't get all mixed up and just get all confusing in a bundle. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for our great theme music. Always a joy. So we'll see you next week with another great show, another great CineCon-heavy show. Not heavy, but we'll talk about CineCon with the Vice President of CineCon, Stan Tappel. And I know that you'll want to listen to that one. So, join us next week for that. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.